This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
The importance of this is that we have a unit where you feed gases and you collect a liquid fuel at the other end.
You know that sick feeling you get when you look at a smokestack belching noxious gases into the air? Well, what if you knew that the gas waste coming from that smokestack was getting turned into a usable liquid fuel? That's the technology that an MIT professor, Gregory Stephanopoulos, and his colleagues are working on. And so far, the results have been quite promising. This week on Sea Change Radio, we learn more about this groundbreaking technology from Professor Stephanopoulos and the promise that it holds. Then we hear from entrepreneur Todd Thorner about independent power producers and the potential of home battery storage technology. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Professor Gregory Stephanopoulos. He's a professor at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, in chemical engineering and biotechnology. Greg, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you. Glad to be here, Alex.
Can you tell our listeners about some of the research that you and your colleagues have been doing in terms of trying to harness waste gas?
Certainly. This is a technology which, let me clarify from the beginning that the technology does use waste gas, but it also needs a reducing gas, such as carbon monoxide or hydrogen, in order to be able to fix the carbon dioxide, which is predominantly present in exhaust gases. Now, in certain cases, like exhaust gases from steel mills, these two types of gases appear at the same time. So in steel mills, you have CO2 and CO, present at the same time, so you can process that gas stream as is. In other cases, one will have to find either hydrogen or carbon monoxide and then use them in order to fix the CO2. The nature of the technology is that instead of using photosynthesis, we use the ability of an anaerobic microbe, which is called Murilla, to fix CO2 and make an organic compound, which is acetic acid. This is the common vinegar out of that. Then in a second stage, we pass this acetic acid solution and it is converted by an oleaginous yeast. This is a yeast that accumulates large amounts of oil. So the vinegar is converted into oil in the second reactor, and this oil is essentially the fuel that can be used for liquid transport, as a liquid fuel for transportation.
And explain how you've been able to take it from just the lab to testing it in China.
This was the result of a lot of energy and a lot of entrepreneurial activity by my former postdoc, Dr. Peng Hu, who is the lead author of the paper, and he comes from China. So after he finished his work at MIT, he moved back to China, has been successful in raising funding for the construction of a smaller-scale pilot plant outside of Shanghai. The results of this pilot plant were encouraging, and now he is moving into the design and the construction of a larger scale plant, which is going to be between a pilot plant and a demonstration plant.
So explain how the waste gas would be captured and your bacterial process would be applied.
In the pilot plant in China, we generate a gas that mimics the contents of a typical steel mill exhaust gas, and this is used to feed into the first reactor, where this gas is converted into acetic acid. So this is essentially a bubble column. It's a tall reactor, and we're bubbling this gas from the bottom of the reactor. The bacteria, the anaerobic bacteria, convert the gas into acetic acid in the liquid phase. And this liquid now is pumped into the second reactor, where it is converted by the oleogenous yeast into lipid. This is how the process operates. In a real-world operation now, we envision that a fraction of the exhaust gases, let's say, of a steel mill, they're going to be tapped from the flue gas which is being released into the atmosphere and is going to be directed into the bubble column where it will be converted into vinegar in order to then be converted into oil by the yeast in the second reactor.
And what kind of efficiency rate are we looking at in terms of waste into liquid fuel?
The efficiency rates are not bad. They are not perfect yet, and the reason is that one needs to do some additional experiments with the integrated system. Let me clarify here that we have researched extensively the individual stages of this system. So we've done a lot of experiments with the bubble column and a lot of experiments with the lipid production reactor. And the subject of the paper that we published was to put the two pieces together and demonstrate the properties of the integrated system. The importance of this is that we have a unit where you feed gases and you collect a liquid fuel at the other end. Now, the performance of the integrated system needs to be improved, but this is not the subject of work at a university like MIT. After we demonstrate something, I think that this optimization is better done in the real environment with the real gases, and this is the goal of the plant, which is presently under construction in China.
This is Alex Wise on SeaChange Radio. I'm speaking to MIT professor Gregory Stephanopoulos. So, Greg, can we extrapolate some of the possible practical uses in terms of where to collect these waste gases? For example, municipal waste facilities, could it work for coal-fired plants, etc.?
Certainly. I mean, but again, with the caveat that if we are going to apply this to a coal-fired pilot power plant, then we need a source of hydrogen. There is a large amount of CO2 coming out of coal power plants, and this is going to require a very large amount of hydrogen as well. If that hydrogen is available from some other source, then the technology certainly can be applied to that system. Ideally, the hydrogen should be coming from a non-fossil fuel source, such as solar, for example, or wind, electricity, which is used to for the electrolysis of water. So one can envision a unit where electrolysis of water takes place. This is going to generate the hydrogen, and this hydrogen then is used to capture the carbon dioxide of the exhaust gases. Another situation could be that of gasifying municipal solid wastes. As you know, very large amounts of waste is being generated all over the world. One potential way to deal with that waste would be to gasify it, and then the gases coming out of that gasifier could be processed in the way which is described in our paper. Now, the gasifier, the product of the gasifier, will contain both carbon dioxide and carbon monoxide, so there will be no need for supplying hydrogen in this case.
And maybe you can explain how your process is unique. There are other companies that are taking waste gas and turn it into liquid fuel. There's a U.S. company called LanzaTech that uses microbes to ferment gases. And then there's a company called Catalysta, which is trying to convert methane into hydrocarbon fuels. How does you and your colleagues' process differ, or does it?
There are some differences. The second company you mentioned is Calista, and they are working directly with methane. We are working with what we call synthesis gas, which is the mixture of carbon dioxide and carbon monoxide and hydrogen. In Calista's case, they are working with methane. I'm not very familiar exactly how they do the methane conversion. Methane is a particularly inert gas, and it takes a lot of effort to activate and convert into products. It is wonderful to burn and generate energy out of that, but if you want to make products, then this becomes very difficult. So I'm not familiar with the details of the Calista process. I do not believe they have published any papers where they describe that their process. For the case of LanzaTech is a company that pioneered the idea of gas fermentations for the production of fuels and products. The technology that they have described is for the conversion of gases into ethanol. And here is the significant difference between the technology of LanzaTech and our technology. Ethanol is the final product, and it has to be separated from the solution in which the conversion takes place. It is produced in rather dilute form, and separation can be a costly part of the overall process. In our case, we make acetic acid, but this is the intermediate product before we convert the acetic acid into oil. And this oil is stored inside the microbes, so it is a lot easier to separate the oil because we simply separate the microbes from the overall process, and then we extract the oil from the microbes, so this can be done more efficiently. Our process is a gas-to-oil process. LanzaTech is a gas-to-ethanol process. Let me note that there have been announcements by LanzaTech in which they convert these gases to other types of products, such as butadiene, for example, and this can be very significant as well. But it is not a fuel. It is a chemical.
And maybe you can speak to the thousands of biogas sites across Europe. We've covered some of the biogas projects here on Sea Change Radio, but from your perspective, they're not using their waste product effectively.
You know, for the biogas facilities, and there are many of them in Europe, as you said, the idea would be to use the second half of the process that we described. In a biogas facility, what happens typically is that you begin, in this case, not with gases, but you begin with a fermentable substrate. Fermentable means a substrate which will be degraded anaerobically if you put it in the ground, and ultimately it is going to produce biogas. Now, in order to make biogas, it will first make acetic acid and some other acids that we call volatile fatty acids. And then if you let the process proceed, it will end up with the production of methane. So one variation of that would be to interrupt that anaerobic digestion process at the point at which the digestible material has been converted to acetic acid, to vinegar, and then take that vinegar and use the second half of the process we described in order to convert that vinegar into lipids. We have studied this process. I think it is significantly more efficient than making biogas, and it would require very small modifications of existing facilities to do that. So that could be another application of our technology.
So, Professor, if you can extrapolate what this means on a larger scale, would this maybe set back some of our efforts to go to renewable energy? Because then we can just look at fossil fuels as maybe not so bad, or is it more than that?
No, actually, I don't see that as a setback at all. I see it as very complementary and helping to ease the burden which is created by CO2 and also the burden which is created by many municipal wastes which are presently dealt with in many landfills around the world. The applications that I see are going to be in capturing some of the CO2 which is released by various processes. Don't forget that when people make ethanol, for example, half of the sugar that is used for ethanol is going to be released as carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. So that CO2 could be captured and it could be fixed with the use of a hydrogen source into the types of fuels that we describe in the paper. The main limitation that I see here, there are two limitations actually. The first one is the supply of hydrogen. If there is sufficient hydrogen or carbon monoxide, then we can capture large amounts of CO2. And the second one is the availability of feedstocks in sufficient quantity to be able to process it in a large enough facility to take advantage of the economies of scale. It is not very cost effective to operate many small scale units. It is better if the feedstock is aggregated. Here I'm referring to municipal waste, for example, and then if it is available in large enough quantities, then it can be processed by a unit that will have the characteristics of our technology.
Would it also be worth throwing in the wrench into the equation that fossil fuel extraction processes aren't covered at all by this?
Exactly. No, there is no connection to getting the fuel out of the ground in this technology. It is only dealing with the products of the combustion of fossil fuels.
And there are issues surrounding CO2 emissions and other pollution-oriented things with extracting fossil fuels.
Exactly. Yeah.
Professor Gregory Stephanopoulos of MIT, thanks so much for joining me on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex. You have a good day, and thanks for covering our work.
Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Presidio Graduate School in San Francisco, offering MBA and MPA degrees in sustainable management. Learn more at presidio.edu.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/seachangeradio and on our Facebook page.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Todd Thorner. He's the founder and CEO of JTN Energy. Todd, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks very much, Alex.
So you're a serial entrepreneur in the renewable energy space. You've started up wind companies, solar, and even hydro. One common thread throughout your four companies in the renewable space is the independent power producer, the IPP. Why don't you explain to our listeners what they are?
Yeah, so the electric power industry in the U.S., you know, for the last century or so has been under a monopolistic model where utilities have territories and they basically generate electricity, they transmit it, and then they distribute it. And then back in the late 70s with the oil shocks, there was a law called PURPA, which opened up the generation portion of the electric power industry to competition. So essentially, the door was open for renewable generators. If you could match the price that the utility would otherwise pay, you could basically secure a contract to sell your renewable electricity to the incumbent electric utility provider. And so that's when we had this first wave in the IPP industry, independent power producer industry. There was cogeneration using steam heat. There was wind, solar, hydro. That first go around didn't last too long. It went through the 80s, and then when the power cost of power dropped significantly during the Reagan years, a lot of the support and subsidies were pulled back. The price of power dropped, and so that whole industry went dormant for about 10, 15 years. And so when I came on the scene after graduate school in 1997 from Johns Hopkins SAIS in Washington, D.C., and looked out at the marketplace, I could see that in Europe, wind power had grown up. It had taken off. Basically, the Europeans had taken the technology that was advanced here in the United States back in the early 80s, and they'd scaled it up. They'd scaled up the business models around it, and there were large utility-scale wind assets across Europe being developed. So when I looked out in the marketplace in the late 90s to see where were the opportunities to try to support and advance renewable energy, I looked at all the different technologies, and really it was utility scale wind that was the technology that from an economic perspective looked like it was competitive or close to competitive with conventional fuels and fossil fuels here in the U.S. And so that's really why I focused first on wind and co-founded Foresight Wind Energy in 2002. And at that point, there weren't a lot of opportunities to jump into solar or jump into all these other areas that have really blossomed in recent years just based on the economics improving. And so at Foresight Wind, we developed utility scale wind power projects, the types you see in TV commercials all the time right now, very large machines out in a remote location. Did all the entitlement work, the land work, the environmental studies, wind studies, and basically put together a package that would allow the facility to be built and constructed. And then we basically would sell those entitlements to a larger IPP, independent power producer company, that actually had the balance sheet or the borrowing ability to build a $200-300 million facility.
If you're a small rancher, you're producing wind on your property, where are some of the avenues that energy would be delivered?
When it comes to power plants, there's a big division on how you sell the electricity based on the size of the project and how you interconnect to the electrical system. And so if it's a small facility that might meet some local loads on the ranch or in the area, and you basically can connect behind the meter, and that's subject to California state rules and Rule 21. If you're going to do a large facility, what they call utility scale facility, which would be, many large turbines or dozens or hundreds of wind turbines, for example, or, many acres of solar panels, that's a utility scale project. And those typically are plugged in at a higher voltage level that can accommodate pushing more electrons through it. And typically that you're, doing a contract directly with the utility. And so if you're a small rancher, that would be a net metering type deal under a standard contract, similar to how people do solar on the roofs here in California. But if you were to do a large facility, if you're in Wyoming and you have 30,000 acres and a company comes in, an IPP company like Foresight Wind, develops a project for 100 megawatt project, say, 40 or 50 large turbines, each one that can provide electricity for, 300-400 homes, a couple thousand people. That type of project basically is subject to federal Energy Regulatory Commission rules around open access. Basically, the utilities have to allow you to plug into the transmission system, and they have to offer you a fair rate for the electricity that you're selling.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to entrepreneur Todd Thorner. So Todd, in terms of overcoming the issue of intermittency when it comes to renewable energy, let's turn to the battery storage potential. A lot of us have been following the Tesla battery developments, hoping that can be a cost-effective solution. It's promising at the very least.
Yeah, so a lot of people like the idea of going off the grid. I think we're still a long way from that. And I think Elon Musk has said as much. He's not looking to provide a technology in the near term that's going to allow people to do that. Really, the Tesla battery, it's a beautiful wall-mounted battery, sort of Apple-esque in its design, and it's shiny, and people want it. But
and it's like $3,500, right?
I think that's the wholesale price point for one of the units that they're selling. And so that initial product that's for retail customers, for homeowners, would be largely for backup power in the case that there's a power outage. And it, you know, based on the sizing of it, you wouldn't want to be putting all your lights on and running your air cooling and everything else. It would, you know, keep your refrigerator and a couple, you know, lights and a few things going for long enough to get through an outage. So the economics aren't there yet to even, they're not even close to really, you know, getting off the grid at this stage. But where storage is exciting is that the costs are coming down very similarly to solar and wind. You know, it really comes down to scale. That for a long time, these were niche industries and they weren't manufactured on a massive scale. And, you know, with the solar industry, China, Taiwan, Korea, a lot of Asian manufacturers got into manufacturing the same technology that, you know, we put on our satellites for 30 years now, just scaling up the manufacturing process and improving the manufacturing process to provide the same technology that's been around for 30 years. And that's really what's been largely responsible for most of the huge cost reductions that we've seen in solar. And so the same thing now is happening with batteries. People are scaling up the chemistries, the manufacturing facilities, really focusing on the process and the supply chain to improve the economics of it. Elon Musk, you know, has this announced gigafactory that's going to be built in Nevada. I think they're already constructing the site. And he's targeting to reduce the cost of those lithium-ion batteries that are used both in the Tesla vehicles, but also can be used by their sister company, SolarCity, in home applications. And he's targeting reduction of those types of batteries by 35%, you know, by the time they get that factory up and running in just a couple of years from now.
And when you look at some of these articles that are poo-pooing it as it's being overhyped, I say overhyped technologies can lead to people buying them, and then in turn, scale will allow the prices to come down, and it can kind of be a self-perpetuating hype machine in some ways. Like if enough people buy these batteries, the prices will come down and it can be affordable. Or that influx of capital from a very successful product can lead to further innovation.
I think that's exactly right. And you know, I think you're focusing on the retail or the home applications, but there's huge opportunities for storage at the wholesale at the utility level for deployment of storage. You know, earlier I touched on wind and solar are intermittent resources. You know, during the daytime there's sun, in the nighttime there isn't. The wind often blows at night. In some places it's during the day. It goes up, it goes down. Electricity needs to be provided in real time. And people don't think about it very much when they just flip the switch, the light works. But there's a lot of machinery and effort and resources controlling different power plants across the system to make sure their output, the supply of electrons into the electric grid exactly meets the demand of electrons in the electric grid. And the more wind and the more solar you add to these systems, the more you need to have balancing resources, other resources that can come in. So if the wind suddenly drops, that you can have some other supply source, whether that's a gas plant or a battery available to make sure that the lights stay on and that reliability is maintained.
Todd Thorner, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Great, Alex. Thanks a lot.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Samford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Stevie Ray Vaughan and the Pretenders.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.